KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. After documentarian Todd Douglas Miller made a short film about Apollo 17, he figured he was done with outer space. Then he got an email from an employee at the National Archives who had found some forgotten film reels labeled Apollo 11.
And in the middle of it, it was actually buried. But the thing that was interesting about it was it had all these bold words in the paragraph and explanation points. And like, if you talk to archivists, they never use either one of those.
Some of the found footage was shot in glorious 70mm. Nearly 50 years after man first walked on the moon, Miller has transformed those reels into his new movie. Apollo 11 offers a window into every aspect of the mission, from ground control to the lunar landing. Miller tells KCRW's Matt Holzman about the enormously difficult task of syncing old audio with the old footage and describes what it was like to show Neil Armstrong's sons images of their father that they'd never seen before. Plus, we talked to entertainment attorney Jonathan Handel about a brewing confrontation between the Writers Guild and the talent agencies. But first on the news banter, we need to talk about Kevin. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So I will say I think, published a story that truly rocked Hollywood this past week in The Hollywood Reporter. Tatiana Siegel and I reported on Kevin Sugihara, the head of the Warner Brothers Film and TV Studio. This is a story that Tatiana and I had been chasing for, as you know, more than a year. You know, one of those open secrets in town that there was something up with Kevin Sugihara and this young, very ambitious, aspiring actress, Charlotte Kirk. There were rumors that didn't lead anywhere, but ultimately what happened is that we obtained quite a huge cache of texts between James Packer, this Australian billionaire who was partners with Brett Ratner, the filmmaker. They had a company together. James Packer was involved with Charlotte Kirk, introduces her to Kevin Sugihara, who he had promised her or suggested strongly to her would change her life, head of a studio. She is clearly in these texts all about wanting roles in movies and not just a background part, like a real role with lines. And what you see as this goes on is she starts what appears to be this affair with Kevin Sugihara. And, you know, it is not okay for an executive to try to cover up an affair, and he is married, by, you know, paying somebody with roles in movies. And this appears to be exactly what he attempted to do, at least help her, an unusual assist, setting her up with Warner's TV or film projects.
Right. And what the texts show and your reporting revealed was that this was a pretty extensive effort. Not necessarily you must hire this person, do it now, but introductions were made, calls were followed up on. This is an unorthodox thing for the chairman of a studio to be doing. And he said at one point in one of the texts, you know, tell Richard Brenner that we met at a party. And Richard Brenner is the head of the New Line division, which makes movies for Warner Brothers. He's not revealing this extensive personal relationship that the texts show in making these recommendations. And to many, that seems like a violation of your duties as the chairman of a studio, if not through a nepotism policy, some kind of policy that governs the way people operate at studios. And Warner Media says they're investigating this now.
Yeah, we should note she did appear in two Warner's movies. Well, one was a New Line label, which was called How to Be Single, and the other was Ocean's 8. His lawyer has said he did not directly help her get any roles. The word directly is what I would call a lawyer word. But this whole incident does provide a window onto the limits of power. You know, you can't, as the head of a studio, it would be a very difficult thing, even if he directly had said, you must put her in this. People don't want to put somebody in a movie if they don't feel that the performance is there. So she had a terrible time trying to get anything. And we do see that she did meet, seemingly arranged by one or the other of these people, with various people. Now, ultimately, they hand her off to Brett Ratner, the partner with Australian billionaire James Packer, who had introduced her to Kevin. And Brett Ratner tells her this in plain language while simultaneously at one point accusing her of extortion. He withdrew that when she protested. But he tells her, we can get you auditions, basically, but we can't get you parts.
Yeah, and he uses some colorful language to say, essentially, you should be going after a producer or a director rather than an executive if you wanted to really help yourself this way. But regardless of the language used, it's very clear that these guys were scrambling to appease an actress who had expectations about what they would do for her. And that is the exact reason why companies have policies against this stuff, because you don't want anyone to ever feel like they need to help someone for reasons other than their talent and appropriateness for a role.
The other thing I want to point out here is that this young woman was 19 or 20 or 21 when she started with James Packer and then with Kevin Sugihara, who was over 50 at that point. The disparity in ages, in power, you know, in the online comments on this story, several people say she does appear to be, you know, willing to do anything for a part. However, the idea that these guys are willing to take advantage of that, that is a thing in Hollywood where you have men in high-level jobs and all of this stuff that they can provide access to, and young women who may be willing to do a lot to get access to the money and fame that could potentially flow. And that is a problem, I think. You know, there was a town hall meeting, as it happens, at Warner Media in New York the day that we broke this story. And we understand there was a question from one of the CNN staff saying, why are there no women in upper management at this point, really? And, you know, John Stanky, who runs Warner Media, said, well, yes, we got to work on that. But you know what? When you don't have any women, when it's all a boys' club, this is the boys' club behavior that you end up getting.
And it's ironic that this story by you broke about 2 hours after that town hall.
Yes, and literally the day after they expanded Kevin Sugihara's responsibilities. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. We're a bit more than a decade out from the 100-day writer's strike that brought the industry to a standstill and cost the state of California more than $2 billion. Now, another potentially epic confrontation is on the horizon, this time pitting the Writers Guild against the talent agencies. The Guild is proposing a new code of conduct aimed at giving more power and, hopefully, money to writers. Control, they say, has been usurped by their agents. On March 25th, the writers will vote on this new agreement, which is expected to pass. It would give the agencies until April 7th to comply with some major demands. If they won't, according to the code, writers must leave their agents. We invited entertainment attorney and Hollywood Reporter contributor Jonathan Handel to tell us what the fight is about. There are two grievances, as I understand it, that the writers are now talking about. Thing one is package fees, which have been around for a long, long time. And thing two is this relatively new thing of agencies getting into producing and owning programming.
The talent agencies, the three largest of the agencies anyways, now have affiliated companies that are actually in competition with the studios and are doing production type activities. But this is larger. The rules that the Writers Guild is seeking to impose would be unilateral, not negotiated with the agents or with their association, and would be subject to revision on 60 days notice at any time by the Writers Guild. So theoretically, if the Writers Guild wanted to say, you know what, commissions aren't going to be 10% anymore, they're going to be 7.5%, the Writers Guild could just unilaterally impose that rule. So it goes beyond the two headline issues.
Now, I have to say, I realize that they are coming in with a big cudgel and talking about taking that kind of power. But sitting here in the cheap seats, I thought, what is really getting them right now is that these agencies are starting to make their own shows and own them, and they therefore have a conflict of interest, they believe, I would think. And I somehow interpreted all this other stuff about challenging the decades-long practice of packaging fees as being a chip, and we're really fighting about whether you own programming. Is that a misread?
I think it is a misread, honestly. I think that the Writers Guild views this affiliate production, this owning of shows, as flying too close to the sun for the agencies. But I think that what it's triggered is something far larger. The Guild has said there's no compromise when it comes to conflicts of interest. And both of these practices, packaging and affiliate production, both of those are conflicts of interest.
Okay, pause and explain what a packaging fee is.
Okay, so the sort of common sense of an agent is that an agent finds someone work and takes a percentage, typically 10% of their salary or their fee as the agent's fee. That's not the way it usually works in Hollywood anymore, particularly in television. The way it works instead is that the agent takes the writer and the script for a new TV series, maybe a star as well, and constitutes that as a quote-unquote package that is then sold to a studio and a network. If the show sells, how does the agent get compensated? Not by 10% from the star and 10% from the writer. Instead, the agency is actually compensated by the studio, which pays a small percentage of the license fee, the cost of the show, of each episode, to the agency.
So I'm a writer on whatever show, and I think, this is great, I don't have to pay a commission, but I don't think that.
Well, the Writers Guild certainly doesn't think that for several reasons. One is they say, if the agent is not getting a percentage of what the writer makes, then where's the agent's incentive to bargain for higher fees for the writer? And if the agent, in fact, is getting paid by the studio, doesn't that really make the agencies beholden to the studios, according to the Writers Guild?
If the agent's getting paid by the studio and they're lining their own pockets, they would have every incentive not to bargain hard. But okay, we'll take that point.
The flip side is what the agencies say is, you know what, if we didn't bargain hard, the writers would walk out the door. They're not under contract. They can walk out the door at any time and go to a different agency. Of course, on the flip side, and you see how deep we get down in peeling the onion now, if the entire system or most of the system works this way, if most agencies are engaged in packaging, then the writer may not have any effective alternative. The fact is, though, that in a lot of cases, the writers want the packaging. You come in with a script and your agent says to you, you know, this would be great for fill in the blank here, your favorite star, who just happens to be a client of our agency. You're not going to say, no. You're going to say, my God, that's great. You've got someone who would be great for my script. Hopefully they're creatively great.
Unless you have somebody else in mind, I was going to say.
You might have had someone else in mind.
Right.
And that someone else might be someone at a different agency.
Right. Then you wouldn't be so excited. I mean, depending on who you are. If you're a big showrunner who can make a lot of noise, I would assume you don't want your agency necessarily telling you who's going to star in your series. But if you're somebody getting a break, then of course you might be very excited to have a star attached to your series.
That's right. And there are what's called split packages where two agencies collaborate so that if the star or the number two showrunner is from a different agency, that this can still be accommodated. But as you might imagine, the agents prefer a full package. They prefer to be able to package entirely within their own agency.
And then they get a bigger number.
That's right.
So the writers, you're saying, many of them don't get hired by way of their agents anyway?
Well, this is a matter of some dispute. The Writers Guild says, for example, that in a survey last year that 75% of writers said, my agent was not the one that got me my last job. And you certainly can find a lot of writers who will say, my agent didn't get me work. You know, I got the work and the agent is getting a packaging commission anyway. But you will find writers who say otherwise. And this has gone so scorched earth that there's almost no agreement on anything between the two sides.
They are saying no more package fees. We want to pay the commission. We'll take that deal.
The Writers Guild is saying that. And they are saying, you know, that money that the studios were paying in packaging fees, that money will come to the writers now because the studios will give it to the writers.
Do we believe that?
Well, when's the last time the studios walked up and down the street just tossing out money bags?
Never happened, and certainly not with writers.
There were pigs wearing almost black Armani and flying down Wilshire Boulevard right, at the time.
At the time. So we're questioning the premise that the package fees, if they don't exist, go to the writers and they all get big raises. Meanwhile, going to this other issue of ownership, I mean, that is something the agencies have been trying to sort of stick their camel's nose into the tent on that for a long time. Really, that was not supposed to be okay for agents to do that.
Well, once upon a time, it certainly wasn't. I mean, historically, MCA was a huge talent agency run by Lou Wasserman in the 50s. He bought a television company called Review, and then later in the 50s bought Universal Studios.
Right. We're ultimately getting to an antitrust breakup of the Lou Wasserman empire.
That's right. But antitrust law is not as rigorously enforced these days. The agencies certainly aren't at the size level that Wasserman and Universal Studios were to attract antitrust scrutiny. The Writers Guild says it's not going to wait around and pin its hopes on federal regulators. What they're saying instead is, look, if your agency in any way, shape, or form is your employer, then you don't really have an agency. What the agencies say is, you know what? These affiliated companies are actually offering better deals to writers than the studios do. And by the way, those studios, many of them are conflicted. You know, you talk about conflicts of interest. You've got AMC Studios and AMC Networks, and they're both being sued now by the Walking Dead profit participants because when you've got affiliated entities, Disney and ABC, NBC and Universal Studios.
Right, we just saw Fox get pulverized by an arbitrator for
exactly that reason.
So Where do you think it goes? I mean, this is like epic battle potentially, right?
Yes, it really is, because the Writers Guild is signaling that it's not going to move. They're not really interested in talking. But the agencies are not going to dismantle their buildings brick by brick and sit there doing nothing. So I think this goes to litigation.
We might see some splintering among the agencies, right? Because there's those big CAA, WME, and then there's other who could say, hey, yeah, we'll do it your way.
Maybe. But what the ATA points out, the Talent Agents Association, is that because the writers could rewrite the rules on 60 days' notice unilaterally, that any agency that signs that agreement has made itself a servant of the Writers Guild and nothing
okay,
more.
So there's some. So you think they won't necessarily peel off, but who sues who? The Writers Guild sues the agencies?
Depends who races the courtroom first.
Right.
I mean,
one of them sues the other.
Yeah.
So, I mean, do you think they all work it out? Do you think they actually fight it all the way?
I think they may fight it all the way. There's so far very little sign that they're going to work it out. The Writers Guild held a meeting earlier this month trying to enlist managers on its side to get the managers to help deal with things, because the idea is, according to the Guild, that writers will leave their agents. And in fact, under Guild rules, if the agent doesn't sign with the Writers Guild rules, and the new rules will be April 7th, the member is not allowed to be with that agent. That's a Writers Guild rule, and you can get disciplined for violating it. So how are writers going to get staffed? This is staffing season now for broadcast shows. How are writers going to get jobs? The Writers Guild says, well, we'll set up online bulletin boards. We'll set up resource centers. We'll set up contact people at each show, et cetera. That's going to be a real test of whether agents are necessary in this system or not.
So would you predict an exodus from agencies by writers?
Jesus, I don't know.
We don't know.
I don't know.
We're in a time of, you know, enormous change, obviously, in the business overall with Netflix and the changing world. So it feels like yet another huge piece of instability in a very unstable business right now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, some people are saying, you know, of all the times, other people say, what better time?
If not now, when? Jonathan Handel is an entertainment and technology attorney and a contributor to The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Kim.
Coming up after a short break, Todd Douglas Miller, director of the new documentary Apollo 11, tells us about a clandestine screening at Cannes. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters.
I'd like to know what you feel as far as the responsibilities of representing mankind on this trip.
That's relatively difficult to answer. It's a job that we collectively said that was possible and we could do. And of course, the nation itself is backing us. So we just sincerely hope that we measure up to that.
In the new documentary, Apollo 11, we hear Neil Armstrong just hours before he launched into space with fellow astronauts Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins. If you're old enough, you might remember watching the historic moon landing live on television. The 50th anniversary of that small step for man is this July. Apollo 11, the film, condenses the 9-day journey into roughly 90 intense minutes using pristine, recently discovered footage covering nearly every aspect of the mission.
Go, GNC, go.
Econ, go.
Surgeon,
go.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
You're go for landing, over.
Much of that film footage and audio had been forgotten in the vaults of the National Archives. It's being seen and heard for the first time in Apollo 11, which premiered at Sundance and is in theaters now. The director of Apollo 11, Todd Douglas Miller, recently spoke to KCRW's Matt Holzman.
So you had made a short about Apollo 17, but you'd kind of done the space thing when this idea came up.
That's true. And I had thought, for the most part, that Apollo 11 had been researched to death. But my archive producer, Stephen Slater, who's made it his mission in life to sync up as much mission control audio with footage. The earlier Apollo missions, it was all shot without sound. So he was trying to sync up as much mission control audio, and it is astronomically tedious work. And
No pun intended.
So when we finished the Apollo 17 short film, Steven said, you know, this 50th anniversary is coming up, and we should do something for 11 in the same style that we did, you know, this Last Steps was what it was called. And, you know, I was just done with it. But then it becomes addicting. We kind of just had an agreement that we would just kind of work in our spare time, you know, almost as on a volunteer effort just to try to sync up some of this footage from Apollo 11. And once you start doing one, you want to do like two or three. But, I mean, to rifle through hours and hours of footage to just get like a second or two is exhausting, but it's also very gratifying because you'll find that sometimes it's a very historically important piece of audio. In Steven's case, Gene Kranz, you know, he sunk up a phrase of him saying, go for landing, that had never been seen sunk up in 50 years.
And this is a famous flight control officer who, if you are a student of this stuff at all, you've seen the footage of them in mission control talking to the people in space again and again and again, and you might have even heard their voice, but you've never seen the two together. So you started with syncing the sound, and when did the footage, this 70-millimeter footage that we've never seen before, come into play?
Well, working with our independent archivists like Steven, we were able to go back to them for Apollo 11 and say, look, we want to cast a very wide net here. We just want to know, first off, what's available to us as far as the 16 and 35, not knowing that the large format existed. And that was at the tail end of 2016. I got an email. I'll never forget the date. It was May 10th of 2017. It was one of the supervisory archivists at National Archives. Big, long email that was basically the completion of a research project. Here's what we have, you know, in-house in our archive. And in the middle of it, it was actually buried. But the thing that was interesting about it was it had all these bold words in the paragraph and explanation points. And like, if you talk to archivists, they never use either one of those. So that began the process of, okay, what are these reels? Because most of them were simply labeled Apollo 11. Some of them had the dates of the launch on them, which was exciting. And we got a couple of those reels. The archivist himself drove them up here, and we tested them.
How does one test a 70-millimeter reel of film?
So our scanner was capable of doing 4K resolutions. And the beauty of it is that it doesn't, not to get too technical, but it doesn't involve any mechanical hardware that actually touches the film negative itself. Everything rides on a cushion of air. And needless to say, you know, the first reel that we put up there was the Saturn V on a crawler going out to the pad. It was jaw-dropping.
In that 70-millimeter format, and especially in IMAX, it's so clear that it is, I mean, this is a phrase that I think people use a lot, but I mean, it is literally breathtaking. You can't believe what it is that you're seeing. And I imagine once you saw that, you thought, yeah, maybe I will do this movie after all.
Yeah, that. And it wasn't so much that reel was exciting, but we had, by on the occasion, we were looking at hundreds of reels. So the very next one that we had was the suiting up shots of the guys on the day of the launch. So Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins suiting up to go do this mission. And I can't articulate the feeling in the room. You know, we were in a small room. There was three or four of us. We just looped it, and we played it for, it seems like, an eternity, just in silence, just in awe.
You just played this film over and over and over again just to watch it because it was so remarkable.
It was just absolutely breathtaking.
But now, we've seen some of that footage before, not necessarily this particular footage, but is it true that some of the 65 and the 70-millimeter film had been developed, and we have seen some of it, but that it was cropped down?
That's correct. So a big part of what became our jobs was to figure out who shot this and for what purpose. And what we found was that the original thinking was that there was large format film. Everybody kind of knew it within the space community for a film called Moonwalk 1, which has become a cult classic. It was a commissioned piece by NASA. It was produced by a really great large format company called Francis Thompson Company. They shot specifically on this flavor of 65 millimeter, and I had known of these films. They're very rare because they typically exist in like art galleries or museums. But what we came to find out was, yes, Moonwalk 1 was responsible for a lot of the imagery that ended up in our film. And we owe an immense debt of gratitude to Theo Kamika, who was the director of Moonwalk 1. He had brought in two amazing cinematographers. One guy was Urs Fuhrer. They called him the Bear. And he used to handhold these big Tadeo Mitchell 65mm cameras that must have weighed, you know, a gazillion pounds. And when you watch the film, there's these really great crowd scenes, close-ups of people waking up to witness a launch in and around the launch pad. And those were the work of a Dutch filmmaker named Jan Spoanen. But then our research actually indicated that NASA, outside of Moonwalk 1, was actually shooting with these large format cameras all the way back to the late Gemini program. And throughout leading up to Apollo 11, we kind of cut off at about Apollo 12. Not to say that there could be some more large format reels out there.
So you did these extraordinarily high definition transfers of this film. Who is paying for all this? Because this is a really expensive proposition.
Well, my last film was actually acquired by Lionsgate and C&M Films. And C&M Films was very interested in doing something down the road. And to their credit, they gave us the freedom, do whatever you want. So when Apollo 11 came around, we knew we were going to do it with or without anyone. The team that we assembled, we all had the single mindset that, you know, maybe we'll get it done for the 50th anniversary, but there's going to be a 60th anniversary. There'll be a 75th anniversary. We'll just do it till we do it right. And CNN had come around and presented an opportunity to go in as partners with us and make a broadcast version in time for the 50th anniversary. They were on board fairly early on. And then we screened a good 20, 30 minutes of the film, kind of clandestinely at the Cannes Film Festival last summer to see if there was, you know, any kind of theatrical response. And of course there was. And Neon, particularly the head of Neon, Tom Quinn, his initial thought was to walk it right in the door of IMAX. We always knew that there would be a Science Center museum version of this, but to have a go at the commercial IMAX screens, you know, generally reserved for superheroes, was the brainchild of Tom and his group at Neon. And I like to say that we had real superheroes, you know, we have real superheroes up on the screen.
So another film has come out this last year. It's a fiction film, you know, obviously based on a true story called First Man, and it tells a similar story, but it is all about getting into the mind of the character. And I wonder, when did you first hear about First Man in the making of the process of your movie?
That's a good question. We certainly knew about it. It might have been through NASA. So Damien Chazelle, the director, and I both had our debut films at Sundance in 2014. I had a documentary. He had his fiction film, Whiplash. And I'm such a fan of his work over the years. He obviously works a lot quicker than I do. And I think it might have came through NASA, although we did share tech advisors. We really, both productions, we had our heads down, but then we also were engaged with the families. So Rick and Mark Armstrong, Neil's sons, were doing a lot on First Man. And they were certainly so helpful. In fact, the first people that we showed the imagery to off the, you know, once we had some of the first scans, I flew out and met with Rick and Mark. And I know that they were on the tail end of First Man at that point.
Seems like a nice companion piece, though, but it must have been very emotional for Neil Armstrong's sons to see that footage, because that's the thing about the footage you discovered. It feels very contemporary. What was it like for them to see that footage that first time?
Well, you'd have to ask them. I don't want to speak for them, but it was extraordinary. I had a laptop. I flew out, and we went to actually the basement of an observatory, which was open to the public, but we went kind of downstairs and kind of this clandestine deep throat kind of moment. You know, their reaction was the same as ours. It's just an extraordinary thing, you know, to witness. The same could be said with Michael Collins and his daughters, Kate and Ann, incredible to work with on the project. Same with Buzz Aldrin, you know, and just absolute highlight of my life is to be able to design a scene, show it to the guys who were there, in this case, Buzz or Michael, and have them basically sign off on it.
Todd Douglas Miller is the director of the extraordinary documentary Apollo 11, which is in theaters now. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's the business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Paul Smith. You can subscribe to The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.